Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Draconian cuts in bus and subway service and a fare hike to boot. We'll talk about it later in the hour. But first...
And all those watching tonight from beyond our shores, from parliaments and palaces, to those who are huddled around radios in the forgotten corners of the world, our stories are singular, but our destiny is shared. The new dawn of American leadership is at hand.
President-elect Barack Obama reaching way out into the world in his victory speech. Let's talk about the world he will inherit with the prolific John Burns, chief foreign correspondent and London bureau chief for the New York Times. Looking for his latest reporting on the Times website yesterday, I found my way to the John Burns file on nytimes.com and discovered the option for search all 2,740 articles. So John is right here in our studio today as he visits New York, back from his recent posting in Afghanistan. Hi, John. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
And we'll talk about Afghanistan in a minute, but when Obama talks like that in his victory speech and talks about, you know, the huddled people in remote corners of the world and everything, do you think it gets noticed in those areas?
Oh, yes. I've been traveling the world for 40 years. Never have I seen such excitement, such passion about American politics. Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, has really lit a fire around the world, a fire of hope.
And is it just hope, or is it potentially transformative? Everybody likes to use the term transformational figure. Is he potentially transformative in ways that will matter to people's lives around the world?
Yes, I believe he is. For all of the tide of anti-Americanism that has swept the world in recent years, indulgent though it may have been in some respects, the fact is that the world still looks to America. American patriots have so often said, as city on a hill, people understand the history of America. They understand how America has been a land of hope and opportunity. These are not just fine words spoken on festival days in Washington, D.C. They're understood around the world. Witness the crowds that gather not just in the main squares of many cities in the world to protest against American policies, but the same crowd, sometimes the same people, who line up outside American consulates in the hope of making footfall in America.
So this is a big question, but are there things that you see as his greatest opportunities, or for that matter, risks, risks perhaps born of two great expectations? Is that an answerable question?
I think the two wars are the greatest risks. To manage American interests in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at the same time to keep alive those hopes that he personally has lighted around the world, is going to be difficult. Difficult but not impossible.
You did an event at the Asia Society here in New York last night, which one of my producers attended. And if he heard you right, you said that Kabul today is getting nearly as bad as Baghdad was 2 years ago. Did you get that right?
Well, I think the trend lines are heading in the same direction. Objectively, it's not as bad yet, but it's a city under siege. Much of the countryside south of the Hindu Kush outside of Kabul, if it doesn't belong to the Taliban, certainly doesn't belong to the coalition forces. In Kabul itself, there is now an increasing drumbeat of assassinations and suicide bombings. And in that respect, it's beginning to look and feel very much like Baghdad 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Now, on the first day after Barack Obama's election, the New York Times reported two immediate international appeals to him. There was Russia's little warning about not going ahead with President Bush's missile defense in Poland, and Afghan President Karzai asking Obama to stop airstrikes that were killing civilians. Why did President Karzai aim his remarks directly at Obama, who doesn't take office for 2.5 months?
Well, Karzai, you have to remember, is running in very adverse conditions for re-election in 2009, and it's not at all sure that he will win. It's likely that he will win. And one issue that he has fixed on, legitimately, you might say, because it matters a great deal to particularly the Pashtun population in Afghanistan, which is to say the population from which the Taliban spring, is this question of collateral damage or civilian casualties from American bombing. It has to be said that the American military command under General David McKiernan, who took over in June, has moved rapidly in the wake of some very unfortunate incidents in the last 3 or 4 months to adjust their policy, to restrain bombing, and to make sure, as they have pledged, and we'll have to see if they can keep this pledge, to investigate promptly and to report honestly on incidents where these sorts of things happen.
And you wrote an article in the Times last month headlined "Afghan Toll Shakes Generals," and it had ominous echoes of the Afghanistan war that the Soviets lost in the 1980s. What is this toll that's shaking the generals?
Well, all of the trend lines are running in the wrong direction. First of all, the shape of the war. The Taliban, who were pretty well decimated after the American-led invasion of 2001, have regrouped mostly from bases in Pakistan and are now able to mass in groups of several hundred at a time, particularly in the south and southwest, threatening government-held cities. The toll in terms of American troops, Iraqi police, and civilian casualties is also rising. It has to be said, before we make any too easy comparisons with the Soviet time in Afghanistan, that the figures are simply not comparable. The Soviets, during their time there, accounted by common estimate for a toll on the Afghan civilian population of between 1.5 million and 2 million dead. 10,000 villages destroyed. We're talking about, in the period of the American military occupation of Afghanistan, figures which are only fractional compared with those.
But there's something about the emotional battle for hearts and minds that was, I think, at the heart of the comparison that you were making. Just last week, you reported on another U.S. airstrike reportedly hitting an Afghan wedding party, and those things have a lot of resonance.
They do indeed.
Any indication that Obama would heed the call from President Karzai to scale back the bombing, because his campaign position was for a troop surge in Afghanistan?
It was indeed, and it's going to be an extremely difficult balance to find. The fact is that the Taliban, common of insurgencies of this kind, are quite effective in using civilian populations as a shield. To the extent that the United States is undermanned with its coalition partners in Afghanistan, that is to say that they just don't have enough boots on the ground, there is a corollary, that is to say there is a heavy reliance on air power in support of ground troops, and air power, although of course now very precise, inevitably is going to cause civilian casualties of a fairly high number. If the Taliban operate, as they so often do, in the context of villages and houses in which there are large numbers of civilians.
My guest, Chief Foreign Correspondent for the New York Times, John Burns. We can take your phone calls for him on Afghanistan or anything else that he's written about. He had an article about the political resurgence of Gordon Brown just the other day. On his way here, I guess, you stopped in London and wrote an article. 212, a few actually, from the UK in the last week. 212-433-WNYC if you want to talk to John Burns. 212-433-9692. Or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. And I don't want to spend our whole time on Afghanistan, actually, but in our pre-election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, we did an hour on Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I think one of the most surprising things about the whole series was the widespread feeling on that show by people we interviewed that the war in Afghanistan is unwinnable by the United States. Steve Call and Tariq Ali and Barnett Rubin, the NYU Afghanistan expert, and even Mayor Ed Koch, were all on saying things to that effect if they didn't use that exact word. I heard Thomas Friedman say Obama will inherit the necessity of cutting back in Afghanistan rather than scaling up, something to that effect. Do you think that's a consensus expert view, that the war is actually unwinnable on the terms that the United States has laid out?
Unwinnable is a big and decisive word. I think you have to also ask the opposite question, and that is, you know, is failure an option in Afghanistan, considering what happened on 9/11 here in this city and in Washington, D.C., an event, a catastrophe that began in Kandahar and Tora Bora. You know, it's an extremely difficult situation to resolve, but the consequences of Afghanistan reverting to to becoming an Islamic militant haven of the kind that it was up until the fall of Kabul and the oust of the Taliban would be pretty serious. As to whether or not persisting with mounting costs in terms of Afghan and American lives, in terms of incremental billions of dollars a month, that's an extremely hard decision. And I can only say that as a journalist who writes about these things, I thank the Lord that it's not my responsibility to try and resolve that.
To make the decisions. Because I think you get to the heart of the matter there. The original U.S. goal, which it's easy to lose sight of, was to destroy the al-Qaeda camps from which 9/11 was planned and to make sure that they aren't reformed as an al-Qaeda base from which attacks against Americans in America or abroad can be launched. Is that the goal anymore? Oh, and can it be separated from Afghan nation building, which is obviously the really, really, really hard part?
That's an extremely difficult question to know. There is some potential for negotiation with the Taliban. The Taliban are a fractured organization, some leaders more Islamist than nationalist, some more nationalist than Islamist. Many of the groups, the Taliban groups, were formerly Mujahideen groups that fought against the Soviet Union. They have their own rivalries amongst themselves. There is some potential for negotiating with them, but the core of the Taliban, particularly Mullah Muhammad Omar, the Taliban founder and leader, who was the target of the first American bombing at the start of the war in Afghanistan in October the 7th, 2001, has made it very clear that he remains committed to Osama bin Laden and Osama bin Laden's cause. And putting a wedge between those two is going to be extremely difficult as a practical military matter.
Ed in Cortona, you're on WNYC with John Burns. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. Mr. Burns, much has been made by McCain-Palin in the campaign of questioning the patriotism of Obama for the very factual data that you've supplied, which is that there's a lot of civilian deaths as a result of Americans' over-reliance on air power. And what I remember reading, and it hasn't been mentioned, is it true that the Southern Command, the British, had given up the Southern Command in Afghanistan for those very reasons?
Well, to speak about the British, there is certainly an unease amongst the British about a whole range of issues, including the winnability of this war, and about the use of air power, which is not exclusively but predominantly American. They are concerned, and they want to see a more responsible or restrained use of air power. But on the other hand, they understand the issues involved. I attended a briefing in Kabul just a couple of weeks ago by the U.S. military command, instructed by General McKinnon, where they laid out their plans to get control of this. And it was the heavy implication of that briefing was a recognition that up until quite recently, that's to say this summer, that they were not properly tracking this, they were not adequately investigating it. And I think there's now a general understanding that this is one of the issues that has to be addressed and addressed seriously if the tide of the war is going to be turned.
Jay in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with John Burns. Hello, Jay.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I have a question regarding where do the Taliban get their arms and their support from? This has always been curious, and I wonder if Mr. Burns could address that issue.
Well, I think the simple answer for that is that largely due to the United States and Saudi Arabia during the 1980s, there was an enormous funneling of weapons, mostly small arms, rocket-propelled grenades, Kalashnikov rifles, ammunition.
This is almost all 1980s-era stuff?
Indeed. This is a small arms war. As I recall the figures, over $10 billion worth of American taxpayers' money went into arming the Mujahideen, who have, if you will, morphed now into what we call the Taliban. So I don't think weapons are their problem.
In fact, you reported last month, if I remember this article correctly, that Afghanistan is asking the Saudis for help in fighting the Taliban now. Yes?
They are. This is an extremely...
What role would they play?
You know, the Saudis, I think it's fair to say, for a very long time, had a kind of implicit deal with Osama bin Laden himself as a Saudi. You take your Islamic militancy elsewhere. You leave us alone. I think the Saudis have understood in recent years that there's no exceptions, and that a triumphant Osama bin Laden will come back for them. So I think that there has been a shift in the Saudi government's attitude, but there are still very strong ties, particularly between wealthy Saudi businessmen and Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda, I think, according to any number of intelligence reports, relies heavily on financing from them.
Obama isn't the only person who represents change in Afghanistan. And Susanna has a question from Westfield about someone else who's newly in charge. Susanna?
I saw General Petraeus speak about 5 years ago when he was actually on the outs with the Bush administration. And then, of course, he took over in Iraq and is widely hailed as having improved situations there. Now he's in charge of Afghanistan as well, having been promoted a couple months ago. And I'm wondering, given the airstrikes issues going on, how do the Afghanis feel and how does your guest feel about Petraeus's new leadership, and do they want him to stay under an Obama administration, or do they want to change?
That's a great question. And for people who don't know it, General Petraeus, isn't he, John, recently made in charge not just of the war in Iraq, but that whole region, including he's now in charge of the Afghanistan war.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, General Petraeus brings with him considerable credentials for the success in the last 18 months in tamping down to a very high percentage, 60, 70, 80%, depending on which part of Iraq you look at, the levels of violence in Iraq. He's been very cautious, not only about what Iraq, fragile but reversible, as he says, the advances there, but also about the degree to which the lessons learned in Iraq are transferable. But I think it's important to note that one of the lessons that the American military and General Petraeus personally learned during the hardest wars, years of the war in Iraq, was never again to get into illusionism. So we're in a curious situation now where General Petraeus personally has been taking care to understate the successes in Iraq and to understate the potentials for transferring some of those lessons to Afghanistan. Now, this is wise, of course, because they're two very different countries. Afghanistan is a much more congenial terrain for an insurgency than Iraq. There are many differences. It's not a sectarian war in Afghanistan. There are many differences, but there are some common points. And I think there is a widespread feeling of hope, if even confidence, amongst the coalition forces in Afghanistan that the change in leadership at Central Command may bring changes in the war policy, which will, if not turn the tide of the war, at least stem the deterioration that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Let me take one more call on this. Everybody who's calling wants to talk about Afghanistan. There is such interest in this in our audience. But then I want to ask you a couple of questions about the UK. Murray in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with John Burns, New York Times, London Bureau Chief and Chief Foreign Correspondent. Hi, Murray.
Hello, Mr. Burns. It's F. Murray Abraham. I'm curious about your reflections on the fact that Alexander the Great couldn't take Afghanistan. He had to negotiate. And the Russians told America, be very careful if you go in there. Is it there must be another way to handle it, is what I'm saying. I'm just curious to know if you think it's just hubris on the part of the military, generally speaking.
And didn't you say in your Asia Society appearance last night that your own British great-grandfather or something like that fought in Afghanistan?
My grandfather, my great-grandfather both served in the British Army in India, and my great-grandfather. So, yeah, I have some personal traces there, though I like to think that doesn't affect my judgment about these things. There's no doubt that history suggests that foreign military occupations of Afghanistan fail, that there's no exception that I know of to that. And there's no doubt that the road home from Afghanistan lies not just through military action, but through political negotiation. But I think it's probably too early to say, because there are so many differences between the American situation in Afghanistan and that of the Russians, not the least of which is the terrible devastation that the Russians wrought upon Afghanistan. Comparatively, too early to say that this mission is doomed. But I think President-elect Obama has an extremely difficult road to hoe.
History suggests how, as Murray points out, history suggests how difficult it is for the West to subdue Afghanistan in any
yes,
way.
Yes, that's clear.
Murray, thank you. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about a couple of the things. Just for background, how long have you been with the Times now?
You age me, 33 years last week.
How many countries have you covered?
I've lost count. I had on a boat off the Mediterranean coast of Turkey late summer, competition with a former congressman friend of mine as to who had been to more countries, and he decisively beat me. But I think we both got up above 100. Unfortunately, he wouldn't accept my definition of having visited a country, which was that if you'd made landfall in an airport. So he struck about 20.
Doesn't count.
20 countries on my list.
This file that I saw with 2,740 articles with your byline, that would be an article every day for 8 years. You file constantly, don't you?
Well, there are others who write more than me, I'm sure. But it's a very exciting life being a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. And the only thing that would be more perfect, I suppose, would be if we could have all of adventure and not at the end of the day have to write. But even the writing is fun.
You did drop off a few articles from the UK on your way over here from Afghanistan, and you tell us Gordon Brown is riding higher after predictions of his political demise, which would have been, of course, so short, his tenure compared to Tony Blair. What's up over there?
Well, Brown was finance minister for 10 years. He's got considerable credit for the way in which he's acted to recapitalize the banks in the UK, lessons which have been exported to some extent to Europe and even back here to the United States.
So wait a minute. Unlike the way the U.S. government is being perceived, I think it's fair to say, he is being perceived by the British people as handling the financial crisis artfully?
Yeah, I think. But you know, this could be a very short-lived thing. The signs in the UK are that Britain is heading for a recession more severe than any other country in Europe. The election has to be held before June 2010. Major job losses are beginning to show up. The situation is very similar to the one that one sees here in the United States. And Brown is 10% behind in the public opinion polls. That's 10% better than he was 6 or 8 weeks ago. So it's going to be an uphill struggle for him to win an election. But I think you could say that he's now back in competition.
Do they see this as an American export, this crisis?
Well, he has been saying that, which is, if you'll excuse me, a little bit opportunistic, because my view of it is, and I'm not an economic expert, that whilst the subprime mortgage crisis began here in the United States, nobody forced foreign banks to buy securitized mortgages, which are at the heart of this problem. So to say, on the one hand, that it began here, on the other hand, that this is solely the fault of the United States, seems to me a wholly different thing.
Last thing, if you happen to know, are newspapers in Europe going through the same troubles as they are here? We have all these stories of papers drastically downsizing. The L.A. Times talking about closing its Washington bureau. The Star-Ledger in New Jersey just cut back drastically. Other papers are going out of business like crazy. Is this happening over there, too, as news moves to the web?
Look, I think newspapers everywhere in the Western world are under challenge, in the UK too. But because of the different structure of the market in the UK, where all the principal newspapers are national newspapers with very high levels of circulation and national advertising, I think that they're somewhat less under duress than we are here. But I have to say, after 40 years in the news business, this is a frightening time to confront. I take heart from what happened last week when the editor of the New York Times, executive editor Bill Keller, chose a single word, as you know, as a headline on the day of the election, Obama. And very briefly, copies of that paper were fetching very high prices on the Internet. It seems to me that there are plenty of people, thank goodness, who still recognize value, indispensable value, one may hope, in the New York Times.
And lines around the block at the New York Times building to buy the paper. You should have seen them, because all the newsstands in Midtown were out.
Well, it may be more hope than reasoned observation, but my sense of it as a foreigner coming back to the United States is that an America without the New York Times is unimaginable.
Yeah, and I don't know if the LA Times is going to close its Washington bureau. I know there was some buzz and rumor to that effect. We'll see if it actually comes to that. Where to next, John Burns?
Well, I think I better get back to London and get back to my job there, and I'll hope to be able to continue to transit back to these places of conflict, because they're the biggest stories of our day, and that's where Foreign Correspondent lives.
And we look forward to continuing to have you from time to time on the telephone from remote corners all over the globe. Thank you for coming into our studio today while you're in New York.
Thank you for inviting me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. We'll hear a clip of the MTA president and CEO Lee Sander telling us riders to expect draconian cuts and take it from there. Stay with us.